You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
No, what?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, no, don't do that. If you shoot him, you'll just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Hello, you are listening to Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. As always, many thanks to Neil and Julie for the past 2 hours, but now at 12 p.m. it's time for another Bums on Seats. For the next hour, it's all cinema, cinema, cinemas. We discuss and debate the new film releases screening in and around the Cambridge area. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me as reviewers this afternoon are, by the skin of her teeth, Emma Marchant.
Hello.
Simon West.
Hello.
Dave Riley.
Hello.
And Callum Burrell.
Hello.
As we spent the last few programmes wading in and out of the rarefied waters of world and festival cinema, it's high time we threw ourselves back into the mainstream ocean. We wrap up a summer season of superheroes with Lucy, Luc Besson's daft-as-a-brush thriller with Scarlett Johansson as a tourist who destroys Paris after unlocking her full human potential. An almost equally silly style of violence follows Dan Stevens around as the mystery man of The Guest, and Philip Seymour Hoffman's old-fashioned German spymaster has as much trouble with his own side as the enemy in the John le Carré adaptation of A Most Wanted Man. Plus, we mark the release of Pride, which we reviewed on our last show, by talking to Colin Clues, historian of queer history and an activist who was part of the original lesbian and gay support the minors group that's depicted in Pride. We have a short word from Owen Baker, marketing manager for the Cambridge Film Festival, who talks about the series of science fiction classics screening at Bletchley Park next weekend. But we start the show by using all 100% of our critical faculties.
What happened? What did you do to my stomach?
We've merely slipped a new package into your lower tummy.
And you're going to transport something very special to us.
It is estimated most human beings only use 10% of the brain's capacity. Imagine if we could access 100%. Interesting things begin to happen. Yes?
Professor Norman, my name's Lucy. I just read all your research on the human brain. It's a little rudimentary, but you're on the right track.
Thank you.
I have access to 28% of my cerebral capacity.
I can feel every living thing.
Since when did you start writing Chinese?
Since an hour ago.
What happens when she reaches 100%? I have no idea.
Age had finally seemed to mellow Luc Besson, the enfant terrible of day-glow French cinema. The director who went to America to dress Bruce Willis and Jean-Paul Gaultier appeared to slip into semi-retirement of making children's films. But his latest, Lucy, puts pay to the notion that he had become a little gun-shy. Scarlett Johansson, capping off a year of memorable performances, is Lucy, a hard-partying American in Taiwan who finds herself kidnapped for use as a drug mule. But the drug, an experimental concoction called CBH4, accidentally spills into her bloodstream. As the narcotic spreads through her system, she finds her consciousness expanding, the reservoir of unused neurons in her brain firing into life. Suddenly, Lucy is a superhero, a lonely god, and a merciless killer, all rolled into one. Simon, with Lucy, Luc Besson has stumbled upon a story that seems a perfect match for his taste in grand and absurd and ridiculous action. Does he make full use of this ridiculous premise?
Well, I think the words ridiculous, absurd, and quite stupid as well can all really be applied to this film. Whenever I see Luc Besson's name as a director, I always get quite a lot of hope, and then I remember that he hasn't actually made a good film since Leon. And this one isn't a good film. However, he tries hard. And he said, I've seen reports saying he wants it to be compared to Inception 2001 and Back to Leon. And on that level, he completely fails. The scenes where he tries to be more than a pure action director and tries to put a lot of intelligence in it are so bad, laughably bad, but getting closer to so bad it's good territory, and it's just ridiculous. However, when he goes back and does the action scenes, which may make no sense in the content of the film or the plot, and he's got to look over it, it's almost like he's doing them in his sleep, and they're fantastic to watch. So it's kind of a mixed film between some really great action sequences in a film which, for the rest of it, is completely nonsensical. And the only reason to carry on watching it throughout is actually Scarlett Johansson, who, despite it being so bad, is just so eminently watchable as always. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, this film. In no way is it a good film, but I can't say that I didn't enjoy it.
Callum, because it's Luc Besson, there's a sort of refreshing lack of, as ridiculous as it is, there's a refreshing lack of Hollywood cookie cutter attitude to how he puts a story together. Were you thrown or delighted by the way he incorporates stock footage into it, the way he allows the story to go off into this metaphysical, as Simon suggested, 2001 style direction, when you think it's going to just become the Transporter 4 or whatever, with Scarlett Johansson in the lead? Did that throw you? Were you sort of kept involved by those strange tonal shifts?
It's interesting. I think because it was done in good humour, and there's a great moment beginning at the start of the film where it intercuts how Scarlett Johansson's characters were feeling with sort of nature footage, which I thought was humorous. Like, the intention was humorous, and it was genuinely funny. And I felt those tonal shifts were good in a comedic sense, if not perhaps a narrative sense. But yeah, I felt it was effective in that regard. Definitely.
Did it distract from how, as Simon's pointed out, and the film is not ashamed of how utterly ridiculous, not just the scientific premise of 10% using 10% of your brain to 20%. We know that's nonsense, and Luc Besson has said, "Well, of course it's nonsense. We use 15% of our neurons at one time, but that's a completely different kettle of fish." But it's, does it distract away from how dumb the film actually is when you get let down? There's barely any plot. Like, once again, for a Luc Besson film, it's a series of episodes with very little plot. Is he just doing his best, like a magician's assistant, to distract you from that?
I think so, yeah. It's just the Luc Besson silly show, and he's having a lot of fun with it. And now I had a fun seeing him have fun. And yeah, I think, yeah, there's no concern for plot on that. As you said, there is barely one. So those sequences gave it energy and, yeah, made it fun. So
Dev, he's got, as Simon's mentioned and the press has mentioned, Scarlett Johansson is very good. I liked her even before everybody else decided it was cool to like her, but this is another strong performance from her, and she's very much a human being in a cartoon world. Everybody around her is not real, and the premise isn't real, and what's happening to her character is absurd and silly, but she tries to find a human element to it. Could you have done? There's one astonishing scene, one very good scene in the hospital where she's talking to her mother as this drug takes hold. Could you have done with a little bit more of that sort of stuff at expense of the car chase? The film just sort of tried to sideline her human aspect?
I'm going to say, yeah, because unlike Simon, I didn't like the action sequences in Lucy at all. They rather dragged me out of what was being quite cool and incredibly false science, but rather enjoyable to watch. In talking about the tonal shifts earlier, yeah, I enjoyed it where she took over Morgan Freeman's phone, TV, lamps, his entire room, using the internet and her brain. I love that scene. I thought that was, we could have had more of that. That could have gone on forever. The scene where she is trying to say goodbye to her mother effectively, but she can't even, I don't think she even manages to in the end. Because
she dominates this conversation with this parade of this.
Her brain takes over and just starts throwing things out there. And she's lost control of her humanity. She's trying to regain it. In the end, I'm not sure what she was actually trying to accomplish by the end of the film, because, well, like you said, there's no plot. It seems to have jumped out the window with everything else at one point or another. But yeah, the action sequences, they all seem like a jumbled mess.
So what are you actually enjoying? As you said, if you didn't, because I know you enjoyed the film,
I didn't enjoy it as much as everyone thinks I enjoyed it.
I'm going by as you said you enjoyed it before we came on air. That seemed fair to me.
my overall review was meant to be meh, sorry. if we're going to talk about recent Luc Besson efforts I've enjoyed, Guy Pearce one. Lockdown? Lockout?
He produced that as a producer. Yeah, he hasn't. He directed The Family last year, which barely got a release.
Oh dear, yeah, I didn't see that.
And before that, it's just been Arthur and his cartoon films.
In terms of balmy fun, if you're going to go for it, you've got to keep it consistent. And I think that's what threw me when I was watching it, was that there were moments of balmy fun. The opening scene with intercutting with the wildlife documentaries, everything like that was perfect, you know, I enjoyed that a lot. But then when he started it really felt like the action scenes were being dragged in, because as we again talking before the show pointed out, she doesn't actually need to go around beating people up.
No, she's super powerful, so quickly that it negates any action.
if she can do that to everyone in a corridor, why can't she do that to people in a corridor around the corner? Which is where there's this apocalyptic battle taking place in a natural history museum.
It gets bored with its own logic. There's two corridor fights in this film. And the first one where Lucy has a parade of a battalion of guns pointing at her, and she just waves her hand and they all fall asleep, with the exception of...
Stick to the ceiling.
That's it. That's what she can do. She can do that. So why is it next time when she's faced with the gang members who have inexplicably flown over from Taiwan, then she sends them to the ceiling? It doesn't make any sense. One, it's more problematic than what we already know she can do. Two, it's not aesthetically particularly interesting to look at.
I disagree with that one. I mean, that is why it's absolutely ridiculous, because it makes absolutely no sense with the plot. It makes no sense within its own logic of the film. It is just ridiculous. But I did think it looked good.
A lot of it
makes no sense, but I enjoyed it and thought some of it looked good with the action scenes, but they make no sense.
I think it's because this film has genuinely seems to have split reviewers down in two camps. Either several quite highly esteemed reviewers who really think this is a good film, one of the summer highlights, along with Edge of Tomorrow. And there are others, like Gavin, who occasionally does this programme, and myself, who just think it's garbage. And I can't work out... I just wish it had done more with the themes. It keeps adding these interesting themes, and then he drops them the next scene. There's the idea that the drug, that the CBH4, is from the hormone that pregnant women produce in order to feed their babies for 4 months. And that's fascinating. And when Scarlett Johansson's being told that, she's looking at the roots of a tree and she's seeing all the information from a tree, a bit like The Matrix. And I thought, oh, they're going down a sort of weird Gaia. She's becoming a vengeful Gaia figure. But no, the next scene, that's completely abandoned. And that short attention span is constantly Luc Besson's undoing, I feel. This is an action film which stops for 5 minutes to watch three identical episodes of the other drug mules being captured. We only need one of those scenes. And he does it three times in a row to no effect.
One of them made me giggle.
it may be a little bit pointer later. There's a scene in the hospital where one of them also tries to run from the gang members. So there's a little bit of foreshadowing there. But it's just abysmal directing, really, really lazy. And I'm bewildered by the positivity other than Scarlett Johansson's performance. And did you think, Simon, that it went in the right direction? You said, again, before we came on air, and it's been mentioned by other critics, that this is the film that Inception wants to be. Did you enjoy the fact that it sort of went into this very, very pulp science fiction ending when she becomes a supercomputer? I thought it was ambitious, but didn't quite work.
Yeah, I didn't think the ending worked at all. Still not quite sure what was going on, what they were trying to do. As you said, it's kind of going to 2001, but at least that does actually make sense after several viewings. But it's intercut with an action scene in a corridor, another one where there's a big shootout, which at that point it really did feel like two completely different films intercut, and I've got no idea why, apart from there is one or two cool shots with a rocket launcher, which again, it's like yeah, he throws in cool shots, which probably look great in the trailer and everything like that, but it has absolutely no bearing on the film or what he's trying to say. I mean, I'm just as bewildered as it sounds like you are about the success of the film and why it works, because on every level, it should not work, but...
It's not even interested in working.
He's not even interested in working. He doesn't know what he did. Like I said, when he tries to be intelligent with the 2001, I thought he completely and utterly failed. I think he's... With the intercuts, with the animal chases and the animal sex and things like that he throws in, I think he's trying to be serious. I mean, Callum mentioned it was great comic effect, but I honestly think he's trying to be serious and trying to be so much more like Terrence Malick or something like that. But it's just so inept. It's funny. And like I said, the most bewildering thing is why I enjoyed it so much. You're saying you don't know why the critics raved it, and I don't know, but I don't know why I enjoyed it. It's puzzling.
So the tagline under the poster should be in quotation marks, "You'll not understand why you're enjoying this."
It's probably just activating the 90% of my brain subconscious, which I don't actually realise I'm
this
using.
This is true. The 90% of our brain that really enjoys tat.
That's what he's actually addressing here.
There's a reason why that's been suppressed by human evolution. That's the 90% of the brain that enjoys The Price is Right and X Factor is being suppressed by Mother Nature. Okay. All right. Well, the film, you'll not be quite sure how you enjoy it, opened some time ago, but Lucy is still enjoying numerous screenings inexplicably at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a Certificate 15. It is fun, and some parts of it are pretty darn good. The first 15 minutes especially, I think, are quite strong. And Scarlett Johansson is very, very good, especially in before she becomes a superhero. Anyway, yesterday saw the release of Pride, a depiction of an almost forgotten moment from the 1984-1985 miner strike when a group of gay activists helped raise funds for the struggling Collier communities. The film, which features an all-star cast including George Mackay, Bill Nighy, Imelda Staunton and Dominic West, is surprisingly feel-good. It finds a bright corner of solidarity amongst a nation at war with itself. When we reviewed Pride on our last show, we wondered how accurate the film was, whilst I personally was probably a little bit too vocally unhappy about what I saw as the film's cosy depiction of the queer community. So Jack Toy, marketing manager at the Arts Picture House, put me in touch with Colin Clues, an activist at the time of the miners' strike and part of the London's group of lesbian and gay support the miners, which is depicted in Pride. I spoke to Colin about the genuine importance of the events shown in Pride, as well as his feelings about the film's treatment of homosexuality, but I began by asking if he thought Pride scriptwriter Stephen Beresford had succeeded in turning a vital moment in LGBT history into a film that could appeal to a wide audience.
I want everyone to take a bucket and start rattling. This is for the miners.
Miners? We agreed on a banner march.
It's a show of solidarity. Who hates the miners? Thatcher? Who else? The police, the public and the tabloid press. It sounds familiar.
Surely,
but the only problem we've got that they haven't is Mary Whitehouse, and that can only be a matter of time.
Mark.
I know, it's not been planned, it's not been thought through, but it's a really good idea, isn't it?
This is a film that was it's intended for a mainstream audience. That being the case, I think it requires a certain sort of angle. Stephen Beresford, who wrote the screenplay, has said, "I'm telling a story, I'm not making a documentary." And again, I think that's important in terms of what the movie has then turned out to be. It's clearly a very broad brush approach. Corners have been cut, various things have been kind of combined. They were very complicated times. They were very difficult times. There was a whole range of things going on. It wasn't just the miners' strike. It was where gay politics was at that point in time. It was around the time that AIDS had emerged. There were still the kind of ongoing issues about homophobic violence. So it is necessarily, if you like, simplified.
In the film, the first visit to the mining community and the few visits afterwards, they met with a good deal of hostility. I know you didn't visit the communities yourself, but was that generally the case?
The way I understand it from talking to members like Mike Jackson is that, no, they didn't face any open hostility, but that was largely down to the fact that the people who were hostile were told to keep away during the visits. So It was there. It was there within that community, but the miners who welcomed sort of the input from LGSM actually made every effort to make sure that the visiting queers from London were not directly exposed to that. There were still, ironically, miners who still took their cue about gays from the Sun newspaper, who was equally just bashing the miners for being on strike.
Was the support given back from the mining community to the gay community as much of a turning point as is depicted in the film? I, for one, had trouble believing it wasn't there. Wanting to know how much poetic license there was at the end of the Gay Pride March in 85 when the buses turn up, and suddenly from one community the entirety of the National Union of Miners is on side.
The situation at the Pride 85 rally was that Blenheim Lodge banner came down, obviously with lots of miners and their families and so on and so forth, and the miners' brass band as well, plus lesbians and gay support might leading the Pride March. The way it's portrayed in the film, I think, is to try and demonstrate that it was actually the broader support that subsequently from the NUM that kind of won the day for us. Again, I think that comes down to kind of thinking about who is the audience that this is meant for. And again, I would go back to what Stephen Beresford said about, I'm telling a story, it's not a documentary. Lots of people will be saying, well, hang on a minute, what about, and myself included, because, yeah, I mean, there's lots of things I kind of see in that film. I think, I'm not sure that actually happened, but there you go. If it puts across the basis of the story, fair enough. It's a film for a mainstream market.
As you said there, it's a film for the broadest possible audience, for a mainstream audience, and there's nothing wrong with that at all, and this is the story that should be seen by as many people as possible. But I was wondering if that aim has led to an oversimplification of the queer communities or the queer characters that are depicted in the film.
I think it's a decent representation. I mean, I could recognise some of the characters in there. Certainly, Mike, I could recognise. I thought that was played very accurately. I thought Mark was played very accurately. So, I mean, I think there were kind of fairly sort of close representations of the people at the time. And again, I just think in the context, in the way the movie was kind of put together.
I was quite willing to be wrong. I mean, again, I might have been going in with, I was aware that I was probably going in too ready to be critical on just about every aspect of it. So I came out thinking, oh, that was disgraceful, but it's not my job to be disgraced or offended. But then afterwards I was thinking, well, actually...
But I mean, at least that's what you get when you try and kind of make a film about red and lesbian gay support of the mind. It's in a Richard Curtis sort of way. You know, that if you apply a Richard Curtis framework to that kind of that whole queer political thing at the time, I think inevitably that's what you would get, really.
But there's only, you mentioned there's A Night of Passion We Don't See, and I don't mean the film needs to show that, or in any, even in a typical sort of shadowy Hollywood way in the way it deals with sex scenes. But their kiss, that kiss, his first kiss, is in shadow, whilst the heterosexual kisses of the two men who are taught to dance by Jonathan Banks is not in shadow. Considering the time we're in, it felt weirdly safer than something like My Beautiful Laundrette, which was made in the actual time itself. I've quietened down about it now, but after the film, I was genuinely angry. I thought there's too much simplification here.
I'm intrigued by your perspective, and I'm intrigued by the fact that you're angry about that kind of particular issue. And I don't know whether this is part of a broader issue about sort of where we are as kind of sort of queers that 30 years ago. I mean, ironically, if that film had been made, or if that particular scene that you're referring to had appeared in a film, we would have been outraged because it would have been about this is stereotype and blah de blah de blah. I mean, I think where we are now is that actually we just kind of see it as all part of a much broader diversity, because there is a broader diversity of representations within the movies.
Neil Van, courtesy of our gay friends down in London.
I'm not getting in that.
Then you'll have to stay here. Can you get lads quick now?
Everybody's cozy. The miners are divorced from politics in the film. We have one Maggie sign, and it's a bit of vitriol from Bill Nighy in a couple of occasions. when they complain about the situation, they complain in terms of tradition. It turns them into people fighting for their country ways rather than a political movement.
See, what I kind of got out of that community, you know, I mean, 30 years late, and having been involved with the miners' strike, both in Nottingham primarily, but also then sort of down in London and you know, by implication in Delias. The thing that I kind of felt after I'd seen that movie, after I'd come out of Pride, was what it just suddenly kind of clicked in my head was this strike wasn't about coal. It was about communities were being destroyed. It wasn't about industry per se being shut down. It was about it was a wider thing. So, I mean, for me, I like the film in the sense that, yes, of course, that's exactly what the film was about. That's exactly what people were fighting for. They were fighting for the communities.
Off. You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Colin for the interview and to Jack Toy at the Picture House for putting the two of us in contact. You can find out much more about Colin's work at his historical website, www.gayinthe80s.com. And you can catch the next Queer in Shorts, which is the evening of queer-themed short films which Colin helps programme, which is on at the Arts Picture House on the evening of the 25th of September. Meanwhile, Pride opened nationwide yesterday and is screening at all three Cambridge cinemas. It is a Certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me in the studio this afternoon are Emma Marchant, Dave Riley, Simon West and Callum Ballarell. Don't know why I gave you a French accent there, sorry. Following on after us will be the new... I gradually become more French throughout the programme. Following on after us will be the new arts programme, Art and Life, hosted by Daniel Pitt from The Junction. The first show features a preview of openings at Kettle's Yard, the latest in sound and vision from Bad Timing, and an introduction to Cycle of Songs, which seems to be an adventure of theatre in the dark, as far as I can work out. Then at 2 p.m, there's 30 minutes of local business with In Your Company, followed by half an hour of the latest discoveries with Science Now. The wonderful Rock Lit with Alan Alder is at 3 p.m, with 105 Sport rounding the afternoon off from 4 to 6. So that's all to come. We've got just over half an hour left on this show. We'll chat to Owen Baker about the Cambridge Film Trust and have a review of Philip Seymour Hoffman in spy thriller A Most Wanted Man. But before all of that, there's somebody at the door.
Can I help you?
Mrs. Peterson?
Yes?
My name is David. Mrs. Peterson, I knew your son, Caleb.
I was with him when he died.
Miss Peterson, are you sure you're comfortable with me staying here?
I think it could be a good thing for us.
You know, I promised Caleb I would do anything I could to help your family. But I'm afraid I haven't been fully honest with you.
I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't been here.
Really, Mrs. Peterson, it's no problem.
Earlier this year, we reviewed Blue Ruin, a simple revenge thriller given a nasty frisson by its horror movie director. A similarly dark treat is promised by the latest film from Adam Lambert, who directed the inventive slasher fic You're Next. I got his name wrong there, didn't I? Adam Wingard, thank you. I don't know who Adam Lambert is. Adam Wingard. He also directed the inventive slasher flick You're Next and is now looking to rejig the home invasion film with The Guest. The film stars British actor Dan Stevens as David Collins, a mysterious American soldier who turns up on the doorstep of a grieving military family. He tells them that he knew their son and that his dying wish was that his family, was looked after. A heartbroken Peterson mother accepts a stranger as part of the family, a substitute son sent to mend her broken heart. Her husband and their two children are less certain of this cuckoo in the nest, but eventually David's friendly demeanour wins them over. But does David's charm mask a man whose idea of a helping hand is one clutching a gun? Emma, the guest is hoping to take a well-worn genre, the sort of home invasion, the sort of standard B-movie, Channel 5's type thriller, and inject it with some new blood. Does the director manage to pull off this strange balancing act?
Yes, I think he does. This was an unexpected treat for me this week, I'm going to say. I often say this, it probably wouldn't be one I would have chosen to see if I wasn't reviewing it for Bums on Seats. Went to go and see it. I mean, it's kind of crazy, but it is done. It's stylish. It has a great vein of dark humour that runs all the way through it. Dan Stephen, who I do know from Downton Abbey, had a surprisingly convincing American accent and was excellent in this role. He does kind of have a slightly otherworldly weirdness about him that really works in this role where you're not entirely sure what's going on. You know it's not good, but you can't work out why it's not good. I found it a bit of a joy. The soundtrack, it's a tight little film. It doesn't outstay its welcome. It has some nasty bits in it, but the whole first half has a great, great sense of kind of menace leading up to, frankly, yeah, a fairly crazy ending. I'm not sure if it entirely, I wouldn't sort of say it's a five-star film and it completely makes, ties up all its ends and makes perfect sense, but it is a very enjoyable, unexpected treat.
Callum, a part of the fun of this film is not quite being sure of what direction it's going to go in. Were you pleased with the direction? Because it starts off as a drama, but then the horror, the opening titles, which sort of slam onto the screen, are in the Exorcist font, and the music's John Carpenter style music, and there's lots of throwbacks to 1980s thriller, so you never quite know whether it's going to be a horror film or whether it's going to be a thriller, or if it's going to be something supernatural or something science fiction. Was that guessing game enjoyable?
Very much so. I mean, obviously in a film like this, with the character of Dan Stevens, you're essentially waiting for the paint to drop because you know there's something off with this person, like from the very beginning, and so you're just waiting for that to happen and what that's going to be. What that actually ends up being, without spoiling anything, is like acceptable and like not too interesting, like thematically. I think there are some ideas there that aren't quite explored in the way that it should be, but the final act, and as far as it goes with like the sequences, and there's a lot of fun, a lot of really dark humour there, it was great. I really enjoyed how they executed it.
Simon, when we were reviewing Lucy, we talked about whether it had done enough with its premise, whether Luc Besson had done enough with the presence of the premise of Lucy. Adam Wingard has a similar situation here, in that he could do anything with his character, with Dan Stevens' character, with David. He could do anything with his plot. Does he make the right decisions? Does he make decisions that interested you in the way it resolved itself and the way it developed?
Bit of a loaded question there. I did like the way it went. I did. The way the film ended up, it was very much a 80s homage to, I think, quite close to a lot of the John Carpenter ones, especially Halloween. I found a lot of parallels from there, except if Michael Myers is a really nice guy, which probably confused everyone else in the cinema in the studio looking at that. But there were explanations and hints, and it dropped in about what the reasons were and the backgrounds and everything like that, but it didn't go too far to explain them. Part of me likes that everything be tied up nicely in a bow, but I also like the fact it was open, because it probably wasn't as important what David is doing or what he came from and things like that. It is equivalent of, like I said, just saying Michael Myers came from institution. It's so, to answer your question, at one point they could have gone more, they could have explained it, but I like the fact that they didn't.
I expected it to be more, because it goes along this sort of John Carpenter route for a while, a sort of domestic drama. You don't quite know what's going to happen, and then it suddenly cuts to this military base and this round table surrounded by generals making decisions, which is great. And I thought, well, I wonder if they're going to do a Cabin in the Woods style thing here, where they start to dissect this genre.
Yeah.
But it sort of abandons,
it
doesn't abandon them, but
pieces out. It almost it's an excuse to bring people with big guns into it, is what that's for. And they could have gone further down that route. At the beginning, you hear about David's plan and what he's actually trying to do, because it's never quite clear. And by the end of the film, none of that's really resolved.
No,
hints.
Yeah.
But it's watching... I've actually seen it twice now. And the first time, I said one of the main things about it was the amount of tension that's built up. Because I've never even heard of Dan Stevens before this film, but he is just fantastic. He's so charismatic. Can't take your eyes off him, but he's got such... Just in the flick of his eyes, it's something like pure menace and terror, and you don't know what's going to happen. So the first half builds up an all attention, and then it starts... The black humour starts coming for, and it's very, very 80s Terminator-esque.
Even limps for the last act of the film.
And I think it's the kind of thing that's been tried many, many times before in, you know, horror, and it's not really been seen that recently. But none of the attempts have been as good as this. This could go down as a classic. This could go down in the same phrases like, you know, Halloween, Friday 13th, Terminator.
But then, do you think it? I'll come to Dave to follow that. But do you think it because the films that Simon's just been referencing are obviously these 80s classics and the work of John Carpenter or as we mentioned, The Terminator or Exorcist or whatever. Does it ever raise itself above mimicry? I found it kind of important that Wingard, who was an impressive director with Your Next and seemed to be doing something interesting with the genre, has fallen so back onto. Instantly into carbon copying somebody else without feeling it added anything. What did you think, Dave? Did it rise above, or is it just another hobo with a shotgun?
It felt. Ooh, I love that movie. now you've ruined my train of thought. I felt you know it mimicked them. It mimicked them superbly. One of the ways it did it was to use the soundtrack very effectively. I think we've all agreed that we love the soundtrack of the movie, and it did hark back to the 80s again. Was it better than them, or
is it too self-aware? Because when the music comes in, it's playing with our knowledge of how that music's used, which obviously Carpenter wasn't. So is that layer of pretense?
He's just using it. So you're right. It may be struggling to break out of the mimicry, but because we don't actually have that anymore in films, it feels really fresh and new, and I was quite happy about that.
I think, remember as well, we're all of an age that we all remember the Carpenter films.
I don't think Callum is, to be fair.
I've got them all on DVD.
Fair enough. But, you know, this is also going to be going out to an audience of 15, 16-year-olds who couldn't really care less about it. So to them, it's going to bring something fresh anyway. And good Lord, in this day and age where, you know, we have Spider-Man reboots, they've made something like 5 Spider-Man films in the space of 10 years, the fact that he's harking back to this is not such a bad thing. I mean, you know, it's hard to find totally original. What I did like was the way at the very end, though, it looked completely like an 80s video set. I was just thinking of Duran Duran and Blondie. It reminded me of the Blondie Parallel Line thing with the dry ice. That was genius.
I think it's a homage to those films.
Completely.
It's just as much like J.J. Abrams did for 8mm, and nobody... Not 8mm, that would have been...
Super 8.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
Super 8. And nobody complained about him resting back in his laurels and doing things like that. But having seen it a second time, of course, I know where the story's going, the tension's not quite there and everything, is actually just how well-crafted this film is. Especially the set that at the end and the timing and the bits in the dry ice, as you mentioned, brilliant, and some of the final shots. And a lot of the early shots, it's... Like I said, it's riffing back to some of those films and... It is just spot on. I absolutely loved it.
Okay, well, we'll wrap it up there. The Guest opened last Friday. That's correct, isn't it? Last Friday, and is showing at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas. It is a certificate 15.
Serving our city and the surrounding areas.
We are Cambridge 105.
You are listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. No sooner has the Cambridge Film Festival shut up shop for this year than its organisers, the Cambridge Film Trust, have the next feast of movies ready to roll. The Station X Science Fiction Weekend runs from September the 19th to the 21st and offers a unique chance to see 30 classics of cinema's speculative fiction in the grounds and buildings of Bletchley Park, the famous home to the codebreakers of World War II. The films range from Quatermass and Peter Cushing's Doctor Who, The 28 Days Later, Dark Star, Silent Running, Brazil, THX-1138 and Spielberg's still underrated AI, with bundles of short films and other rare science fiction classics also screening across 7 screens, both indoor and outdoor. I talked to Owen Baker, once a review for this show, but now he's tucked his shirt in, the marketing manager for the Cambridge Film Trust, about the weekend. He spoke about how the Cambridge Film Trust is working with partners to create an ambitious 3 days of films and how the historic Bletchley Park location is being used to add ambience to the evenings. But he began by talking about how Station X works with the BFI's Summer of Science Fiction.
The scenes you are about to see are more incredible than anything today's science or fiction ever imagined.
It's come about because the BFI are doing this Days of Fear and Wonder sci-fi kind of... That's the thing they're pushing this year. And so there's a huge catalogue of sci-fi films that are being presented by the BFI, and Station X, Bletchley Park, because of it's just an incredible venue in which to host a selection of sci-fi films. It's, you know, it's long history, you know, the sort of code breaking, the Enigma computers, the home of British, certainly, and probably world computing in a lot of ways. It's just the perfect place to be hosting something like this.
You've mentioned outdoor screenings there. You mentioned a ballroom. Are there going to be a mix of indoor-outdoor screenings? Is it very much like a rock festival, but instead of seeing the latest bands, you're seeing a mix of science fiction films, depending on which stage you go to, and there'll be small stages and big stages, as in small screens, big screens?
Yeah, absolutely. And not just that. I mean, also, huge amounts, there's going to be actors, and there's going to be alien crash sites and huge sort of set dressing and all sort of, like, really quite an extraordinary event. I think it should be really great. Moon buggy tours around the site, and we've got some great people involved with that, and there's going to be also talks by people in about the relationship between science fiction and film and the sciences, and we're hoping to have, you know, between 400 and 800 people a night for 3 nights. It's a significant undertaking, and you've absolutely got to draw people from further afield, even than the Cambridge Film Festival does, I think.
Post-Cambridge Film Festival, people are still unaware of the role that the Cambridge Film Trust, rather than the Arts Picture House, but the Cambridge Film Trust, plays in that festival. What role are they playing in Station X? How are they involved? How is it a Cambridge Film Trust event?
This event is being run jointly by Cambridge Film Trust and with Independent Cinema Milton Keynes. The Cambridge Film Trust came on board largely, I think, as an established organisation that had run events of a similar scale before. Perhaps, I think it's fair to say, it's a slightly bigger event than ICMK have run before. They've run a lot of arts events and cinema events in and around the Milton Keynes area, but maybe not quite on this scale before. And like you say, it's 30... nearly 30 films over 3 nights, you know, so it's a big undertaking. The Cambridge Film Trust have a lot of experience of running cinema events, both, you know, outdoors and, you know, in separate sites, if you like, running those kind of events. And I think that expertise is very much the thing that the Trust is bringing to this event.
So it's an Independent Cinema Milton Keynes. Is this part of the, falls under the work that the BFI Audience Network are doing?
Yeah, yes, very much so. I mean, this is very much seen by the BFI and by us at the Trust as a kind of, it's one of the main events as part of the film hub, of which obviously Cambridge Film Trust are a lead member in the film hub Central East. That's really about taking cinema out into areas, particularly geographic areas which haven't had that kind of support in the past. So it's anything the Trust can do to enable other, you know, I don't like to say smaller organisations, but organisations with a bit less experience of this kind of scale of project, enabling them to do that is very much falls within the remit of the Audience Network, BFI's Audience Network, and the Film Hub Central East.
Who went into choosing the films that are screening? It's a vast array, from short films and fairly new Spielberg to things to come.
The programming, I think, is trying to reflect in a similar way that which the film festival, the Cambridge Film Festival, does, trying to kind of reflect the full range from the kind of fairly mainstream stuff. Like you say, we've got Spielberg and we've got 28 Days Later and, you know, like I said, Thunderbirds of Go and Doctor Who and the Daleks and things like that, right through to the much more obscure stuff, you know, right, you know, we got the first presentation in the UK of Cosmic Voyage, and with a live accompaniment from Neil Brand. So, you know, those kind of things. It's about taking a slightly more interesting film to areas where perhaps they're served by multiplex cinemas, but not necessarily by, you know, the more art house fare. So there's there's a full range of films being shown.
Over three nights, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, there's a variety of ticket options for each night, and seeing the number of films or events that are on that.
It's not complicated, but there are various options. So there's you can book a weekend pass, which entitles you to come every day for the 3 days. And you can also book that with access to Bletchley Park, because this event is happening when Bletchley Park closes in the evening. So effectively you can stay on if you want, but and come to the event if you buy a ticket, but it's separate. So you can buy a full price weekend pass for £30, which entitles you to access to all three nights of the event. So plenty of time to see lots and lots of films. A concessionary weekend pass is £26, so that's again a significant reduction. Day passes, so for one day of the event, are £15 each. And under 12s go free. And one, as a similar pricing structure to the one that we had at Grantchester Meadows screenings just before the festival, in that if an adult buys a ticket and comes with up to four children, they can get them in on one child's ticket. So there's a big saving to be made there. I would point out that all the information is available on the website, which is www.stationxscifi, all one word, .com. And you can buy tickets online from that website as well.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Owen for the quick interview on a busy Thursday afternoon. As he mentioned, you can find out more about the Sci-Fi Weekend, which is this coming weekend, so a week today, by visiting the following website, www.stationxscifi, all together, and sci-fi is scifi.com. Though only three feature films into his career, director Anton Corbijn has shown a liking for Isolation, the shattered rock star of Control, the doomed hitman in The American, and now, in new release A Most Wanted Man, the lonely fag packet life of a spy. Adapted from John le Carré's 2008 novel, A Most Wanted Man focuses on spy master Gunther Bachmann, a final starring role for Philip Seymour Hoffman. Bachmann is an old-school spy, a patient ringleader for a group of agents tasked with infiltrating Islamic terror groups based in Germany. Into their midst arrives Isa Karpov, an apparent Chechen terrorist with a large sum of dirty money to collect. Bachmann sees a chance for one case to help another. If Karpov's money could be channeled into the hands of a suspected gunrunner, then there's a chance the resulting tumble of dominoes will lead them to the Al-Qaeda cells they're tasked to crack.
German intelligence needs a job to be done. There's a German law won't let it do. Our unit was set up to develop resources.
We're not policemen.
We're spies. Our sources don't come to us.
Hi, Oliver. Good to see you.
We find them. When they're ours, we direct them at bigger targets. It takes a minnow to catch a barracuda to catch a shark.
Dr. Abdullah moves money through a network of Muslim charities, and every time he does, some of it goes missing.
He's moving the money to a shipping company.
He's got a lot of friends here in Berlin.
Watch your back.
The man's tolerant and engaged with the West, but every good man has a little bit of bad, doesn't he? And in Abdullah's case, that little bit just might kill you.
We have 3 hours to apprehend Abdullah, make him ours.
Callum, A Most Wanted Man offers old-fashioned thrills, very old-fashioned thrills. There's no violence, there's no sex, there's a brief foot chase. Rather, it hopes to build its tension through the slow gathering of this case these spies have. It's almost a procedural, really. Did you enjoy this, in this day and age, fresh take on the spy movie?
Yes, extremely. Yeah, I thought it was incredibly well put together, very engaging. The characters are all brilliant, even though some of the subplots with particularly around Willem Dafoe I felt were a little bit undercooked, but the performances are great, especially of course obviously with marketing surrounding Philip Seymour Hoffman, who's somewhere between like charismatic and repulsive. He's just this wonderful figure at the centre of the film. It is an old-fashioned film in the way it builds tension. It doesn't rely on any sort of visceral shocks. But it builds up incredibly well, and it's not tense in a sort of nail-biting fashion, like you're consistently like worried or nervous, but it does, there's a lot of spinning plates which it manages to hold, I think, almost perfectly, and by the finale, yeah, it's all come together in a very satisfying fashion. So definitely, yeah.
Emma, you were slightly less convinced. You said this during one of the pre-records, not disliking it, but slightly dwelling a little bit on it.
Yeah, I couldn't. I came out feeling maybe slightly underwhelmed, but that could be because I don't know. Maybe it's not maybe a. I always say this kind of like a Friday night. You know, you've got Friday night films, which are Friday night films, and then you've got films which are maybe this would maybe more of a Tuesday or Wednesday night film. Pretty esoteric. It does have. I mean, it is excellent. I love that you said charismatic and repulsive because that just nails Philip Seymour Hoffman in this. He is such a sad, schlumpy, you know, physical presence anyway, and he is. You know, it just makes looking like a spy look insanely depressing. Really, even you know, even more so than Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, and this is like 20 years on. But Hamburg itself is shot excellently. We were all talking about this beforehand and just, you know, using, seeing a city which you rarely see as a kind, you know, Hamburg is rarely a city that films are made in and about. And I just, it almost is like the whole other character for the film. And that was excellent. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe I could have just done. Maybe I'm just a very, very cheap and trashy.
Did you need another foot chase?
A bit more. Maybe I needed a faster foot chase. Maybe I just needed. Yeah, maybe one gunshot or something would have been nice. I don't know. But the more I think about it, the more I appreciate what a great, well-rounded piece of grown-up. I know it's a bit of a cliche, but it is a grown-up piece of cinema. It's brilliantly directed. It's brilliantly shot. And we were disagreeing slightly about this, but I think pretty much the cast as a whole nail it. Robin Wright is excellent. Willem Dafoe is excellent. And it is centred by this, you know, and there is, again, obviously there's emotion around that. Knowing now, you know, obviously knowing now what has now happened to Philip Seymour Hoffman, it kind of does add an extra layer. It's hard to forget that while you're watching it, but it's a brilliant performance.
It is a performance of a character who shouldn't be seen, but also has to be the centre of attention at all times. Being a spy, he should be invisible, but obviously that doesn't do for a movie star. Simon, you were saying that you enjoyed. It's just simply a good story, well told. You know, that is a rarity these days.
It is. It didn't try to do any cheap tricks. It didn't try to fool the audience or pull any, stunts or anything, which is what you half expect nowadays. As we said, there's no violence, no big chase scenes or anything like that. It was just a very, very good, well-told story by an absolutely tremendous set of actors and a very interesting director. I mean, sometimes you just don't want more than that. It's just everybody involved being excellent at the top of their game. There's, you know, not too much to say that hasn't already been said. Philip Seymour Hoffman, again, we're just saying it's such a shame because you can't take your eyes off him, and there's so many moments in the film where it's just the subtle touches you kind of notice about why he was such a good actor and, you know, how fantastic he was.
It's a performance that actually doesn't come into its own until not just the end, but the last, say, 20 or 25
minutes.
Yeah,
I mean, my favourite scene was, just to share, is the scene when he was on a boat trying to comfort a double agent who's starting to
have doubts.
Starting to have doubts. And he's trying to do the father figure thing. He's just listening, and he's just gently nodding his head at the other guy's talking. And it's just those kind of movements that raise one actor, I think, above another one who could just be sitting there listening. And it's just,
I think what was really interesting is
he was just magnificent.
What I really liked when you said about spies having to be invisible, what I really liked in this is you never ever see a shot of him at home. Even say in Tinker Tailor Soldier
Spy. Oh, no, you do. He's playing his piano and drinking yet more bourbon.
Yeah. I thought that was the office.
No.
There you go. Well, sorry, I take that back then.
Old German officers do come with a piano, so yes. So they can play Bach.
They should do. I'm sorry, I apologize.
Bach break and some
I
like
that, but I enjoyed the fact you didn't sort of have any idea of his existence really outside of.
I don't think he did have an existence. That's the thing. He's one of the ones who's so into it. He didn't have an existence. Between the relationship between him and his lieutenant, Anna, played by Nina Haas, which is, again, it just seems to be spot-on office romance, no romance, but it's just two professionals who are out to do the job. And it is almost like they had no one else. But that's not really taken. That's not a big subplot or anything like that. That was just things you can in tune just because of the action and the performances, which really make the whole characters whole.
Is there an issue here? We haven't got very much longer, but is there an issue that this performance and it's part? I've always felt that Seymour Hoffman was probably a little bit more of a very, very strong supporting character actor rather than a star, and he's a star here. He's brilliant, yes, but it sort of unbalances the film. It unbalances the story. There's a lot of every character is equally as important as he is, especially Issa, the Chechenian terrorist in theory. Mm. And he drifts away from the story entirely and is underplayed almost irresponsibly by the actor involved. I thought that unbalance and that stops the middle act of the film sags quite badly because of that.
Maybe that was. I don't think so. I think it's interesting because, of course, the whole point is you're not really meant to know whether he is a Chechen terrorist, whether he's just suspected exactly what he is doing there. So I didn't have a problem with the way
he's
played.
Meant to be a bit of an enigma. So but even
he's also insanely post. He's also got insane post-traumatic stress. Yeah. I would imagine from the torturing that has occurred to him. So I think, I think that's unfair to that actor.
But that is. They did surround him by great actors. I mean, Willem Dafoe, always makes a bad guy, but here he's just straightforward, playing a normal person, letting his acting do the talking.
Yeah.
We were saying earlier about, he's known for being quite ugly, which is a bit unfair on him, but...
Willem Dafoe? No.
Well, he's incredible looking. I mean, he's just incredible.
He's got an incredible face, but that kind of thing. But they don't play on that at all or anything like that. You got him in Green Goblin and other things. I know that's a superhero film, but he is just again playing somebody normal, but absolutely fantastic performance.
It probably says something about the cast that Daniel Brühl, who starred in Rush, who was very good in Rush, has been
he's great.
Is in this and barely, is one of the team and is barely, because you are surrounded by so much, so many.
Well, he stood no chance of actually being higher up in the cast on this film because he's a German actor and playing a German. They wanted American actors to play all the Germans. So he had a natural disadvantage of being the right nationality, but which is a bit of a shame, I think. So, in the end, I think rounding up just a few seconds, Callum, do you think we need more of this? It'd be nice to have more of this sort of film that doesn't treat its audience. But the Bourne films are fine, but when they're your adult spy caper, there's something a little bit lacking, I think.
Yeah, I think we do need more of this kind of film. And we do get them occasionally. I guess it's sort of a marketing issue, obviously. With the Bourne films, they can, and they're great, but they can shove car crashes into their trailer and they're much easier to sell. And that's just a very cynical truth of the matter. But yeah, I think we do. I think there is definitely an audience for it. And hopefully this film does very well and that will prove to studios and the producers that this is something worth pursuing, certainly.
Okay, well, A Most Wanted Man opened yesterday, Friday the 12th, and is screening at both Cineworld and Art Picture House cinemas. It is a certificate 15 for language, really. And that is, once again, all we have time for on the show today. As is customary, the last hour will be tied up neatly into a bow of a Cambridge 105 podcast. And don't forget that we can be found on Facebook and Twitter, and you can email us via bumpersonseats@cambridge105.fm. It would be wonderful to hear from you. We'll be back on October the 27th with lots of Hollywood revenge fantasies. Denzel Washington in The Equalizer and Liam Neeson in A Walk Among the Tombstones, plus David Cronenberg's A Map to the Stars. We'll finish up with some of the score to Charluta, Sajid Ray's brilliant film, which is being screened at the Arts Picture House at the moment. Please stay tuned for Art and Life, but from all of us here on Bums on Seats, goodbye.